Wistful Thinking is brought to you by the Cage Club Podcast Network. For more things, movie, and nostalgia podcasts, visit cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me.
Welcome to Wistful Thinking, week 3 of quarantine. I'm pulling Jordan Clark. Nope, I'm not. That's not even your name.
Not only are you not, It's okay, try again. Times are weird. Try again.
Times are so weird. My name is Kara Gail O'Regan. My co-host's name is Jordan Poland Clark. Jordan, how are you doing?
Super weird. Super weird. I feel I've reached the phase of quarantine where I'm so bored that I just don't even have any words to say anymore, which is going to make for a super interesting podcast, let me tell everyone.
Cool. Today we're going to talk about Todd Haynes' Safe by Todd Haynes.
You're doing great, Kara.
This is actually one of my favorite movies. It came out in 1995, but it's a period piece set in 1989, starring Julianne Moore in her first starring role. As the IMDb description says, that this movie is about an affluent and unexceptional homemaker in the suburbs who develops multiple chemical sensitivity. And this is actually one of my very favorite movies. And I love making people watch it because it's such an interesting, what people get out of it is such an interesting mirror of their own, attitudes about illness and stuff.
It also, so this was the first time that I had seen this movie, and every single shot of it is perfect.
Perfect.
I mean, I think I haven't seen very many other Todd Haynes movies, but I believe that is how he makes movies.
It is. And something that strikes me every single time I watch one of his movies is how much physical distance he manages to put between two characters that are both in the same frame.
Yes.
It's uncanny, and he does this in, almost all of his movies, I think. There are some, great scenes in Carol like this, where, people are in completely different rooms, and they're talking to each other, and they still, the way that the set has been built, or the way that he's, framing wherever they're shooting, it's like they manage to be in completely separate spaces, but still communicating. Which says everything about all of his movies.
to your point, it's a pretty perfect movie, and it does not, it draws no clear conclusions about
anything. It makes people really mad sometimes.
I didn't feel mad, but I do feel like I watched it and was like, cool, not sure what I just watched. Because it's seems super open-ended.
Unsettled. It's unsettling. When they premiered this at Sundance, half the audience got up and walked out.
I'm glad I didn't have that reaction. I mean, I really liked it, and honestly, it makes me want to watch. Because of that, it just makes me want to watch it over and over again, maybe, and to see what I can pull from it differently.
I've seen it 10 times, and every time I get something else from it. But the thing that made people really mad about it at the time was that Todd Haynes, this, vanguard of the new queer cinema, was making this movie about illness at the height of the AIDS crisis that didn't directly address the AIDS crisis. No one in this movie is a bad guy necessarily, but the one person who could be taken as a bad guy is the one person in this movie.
I think there's several people who actually might be bad guys, but
okay. See, I find it really interesting because no one people are frustrated with her and frustrated with the situation, but no one the doctors that she sees, her husband, no one's being an outright asshole about it.
Well, but
they're just
not
as frustrated
true.
As she is.
Yes and no. I think by the middle of the movie that's true, but like literally I wrote down almost no notes about this, but here's one that I did write down. Like literally her husband says to her, "I don't want to hear about it."
Yeah.
Like when she first gets sick, like he is a monster to her, and we can only assume
yes, he is. I don't think that he is at all. No.
Yes, he is.
All right.
I mean, like, I think we've seen worse, and I think worse exists, but I think as far as, like, a human being who is in this woman's life, like, no thank you.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I wouldn't want to be married to him, but I don't think he's a monster by any stretch of the imagination.
I think you can see that he's more complex than that eventually once he, you know, it's like he abandons her, you know, once all this becomes, like, more real to him. Mm-hmm. But, like, like at first he's basically just pissed off at her because he thinks she's lying so she doesn't have to have sex with him.
And honestly, who would blame her?
Well, I know, because the like that first scene in the movie, like, ooh.
Yeah. Yeah. So I love this movie. Like I said, it's one of my favorite movies. And I, because of my own experience with chronic illness, have a very different read on this movie than most people do. Like, most people see it and just kind of see it as this, like, allegory for, like, the disease of modernity and, like, housewife unhappiness and whatever. And, like, that's definitely in there and you can see it, but it's also, like, a very straightforward story about what it's like to get mystery sick. And just how unsettling that experience is and how vulnerable you are to predation and manipulation and how desperate you kind of become just looking for answers and looking for anyone to tell you what is actually going on because no one knows. And it's incredible to me that they made this in like 1993 or whatever, you know, and that like very little has changed for people who experience these kinds of symptoms.
Yeah, that was one thing that struck me, and like I'm able to view it through like a similar lens, although obviously different from yours, but just because I know you and I talk to you at length often, like I certainly like was able to have that lens while I watched this. But yeah, it struck me like you could make this today and you wouldn't have to change a single thing, and like it would still be a perfect movie.
Right.
Or like so it would still just have just as much to say, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's so interesting to watch it now.
yeah.
Like of all of the times. Because even though this isn't explicitly about the AIDS crisis, it's the backdrop of it is the AIDS crisis. And a lot of the stuff that we hear kind of in the background on the radio and like the sonic fabric of it is referencing what was going on at that time with the AIDS crisis. But so in the movie, Julianne Moore's character starts experiencing all of these like mystery allergic reactions and asthma attacks, and starts to see all of this information around about environmental illness, which is kind of a broad term that refers to really like anything that makes you sick in your environment. So for some people, it might be fragrances. For some people, it might be like cleaning products that make them sick. For some people, like the big kind of inciting incident for her, even though we see that she's actually had symptoms already, the thing that like really sets it off is that she gets this new couch that's like off-gassing in her house. And at the time, like this all seemed very crazy. But now I think like one thing that has changed is that enough time has elapsed that like we understand that like fragrances and chemicals can make you sick now.
This is like a thing that people have heard of now.
Right. And you know, the words for it have kind of changed, and the treatments and diagnostic approach has changed somewhat, but like part of the reason that I love this movie so much is that it mirrors a lot of my experience with something called mast cell activation syndrome, which is one of my weird diseases. And like I watched this and I'm like, oh my God, Carol has mast cell activation syndrome. But I think that like anyone with any chronic illness would watch this and be like, oh my God, she has what I have.
Yeah.
But like the thing that I have does actually make me have, you know, mystery allergic like reactions to things and stuff. So a lot of like in the movie, she goes to a hair salon and gets a perm and gets her nails done and has like a horrible kind of reaction to all the chemical smells and stuff. And like I can't go into salons for that same reason.
They do a really good job of like making, I mean, so the sound design in this is really good too, in addition to it being like perfectly shot. And they do a really good job, particularly like at the beginning when she's still kind of doesn't know what's going on and like is experiencing these things. Like, it's so, they make all that stuff seem kind of gross.
In what way?
I just like I felt like she was being poisoned when I was watching her get her nails done and like, you know, her hair permed. So I just think they did an effective job of that.
Yeah, they
I
do.
do I like the first flyer that she finds is at her gym, and it says really big, "Do you smell fumes?" And the first thing it says is, "Are you allergic to the 20th century?" Which I liked. And then it's a whole other list of things that are more specific, but
Yeah, and that like that concept of being allergic to the 20th century is like a main, I wouldn't say like thesis for environmental illness, but like definitely is a theme of this movie. And like the just the way that like her house is furnished and stuff is like ultra modern. That's actually the interior of her house is Todd Haynes's aunt and uncle's house. Basically like all of the houses in this were like his parents' house, his aunt and uncle's house, his grandparents' house. Which is funny. I have the Criterion Blu-ray of this, and there's a great director's commentary track with him, his producer Christine Vachon, and Julianne Moore, and it's really interesting to watch this movie with them talking about it. Especially the thing with the couch when they like redeliver the couch on the commentary, Christine Vachon was like, and this was when you turned to me, Todd, and said, "Am I making a movie about a couch?"
I
Which made me laugh really hard.
mean, a little bit for a minute there. Yeah, that was like a really big plot point for a second. I also, so the other thing that this movie really is split into like two different parts. It's like the part where she's still living in her life where we meet her, and then she leaves to go to this, what would you call that place?
It's a retreat center.
Okay, she goes to a retreat center that also might be a cult. And but so when she's in her regular life, like you mentioned, that like somehow they do this thing where like there's these dis there's distance between people who are appearing in the same shot. But what also happens a lot is she appears in shots with the not white people that she employs often. I would actually be curious to go back and watch that again, because I don't know that it, like, I don't know that it went on to make any like kind of further commentary about that, or maybe it was just like that was his way of like illustrating her life, like fleshing out her life. But like, I did find that interesting, and then it kind of went away and like had nothing to do with the rest of the movie.
Interesting. I'll have to pay more attention to that the next time I watch this.
It's like she would be alone, but she wouldn't be alone because the people who worked in her house would be there.
Yeah, interesting. But this character is basically like she's alone regardless of where she is or who she's with.
Yeah, and that's another thing that happens like often, is like even when he's not using like two rooms in a single shot to split up people, like she is always separate from the group of people except for one time. Ish. You know, they'll sit in a circle and she'll be like 3 feet away from everybody else. Like,
right. She's social distancing.
Yeah.
A pioneer.
She's not really far enough, but.
Yeah. But even the way the camera works, like there are so few close-ups of her. Even though she's the main character in this movie, like the camera is actually like working against your like default sense of like wanting to identify with the main character and like always kind of keeping her at a distance. And really the only kind of close-ups that we get are those like unsettling like dolly in zoom out shots.
Well, it's shot like a horror movie.
Yeah. Well, because it is a horror movie.
Yeah. It,
like not on its face.
Not a traditional one, but yeah.
Yeah. My favorite kind of horror movie.
We've talked about
you thought you were just going to watch a nice movie about a housewife, but really, it's a horror movie.
I didn't think that. I was uncomfortable from the moment it started. We've talked about this before, this like tool that directors use to, excuse me, this tool that directors use to separate the viewer from the character, and often mm-hmm. it's used as a tool to make us know that somebody doesn't know themselves
mm-hmm.
by not allowing us to know them either. Mm-hmm. We've like talked about this like a lot in one movie, but I can't remember what it was. Do you remember?
Nope.
Yeah, no, I can't remember anything we've ever watched.
It's interesting that you say that, though, because, like, Julianne Moore, in talking about how she kind of embodied the character and developed the character, she's talked a lot about the way that she manipulated her voice for this movie.
And it's that it's a little tiny voice. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very tiny, and it, like, never actually hits her vocal cords.
And she said the words, "I'm fine," so many times. I, like, almost stopped to start a tally.
Yeah.
In that, like, tiny voice.
Yeah, so like even the character, like you said, like doesn't even know herself and doesn't even fully inhabit her own body and her own space.
Well, and that's,
she's always trying to take up as little space as possible.
I mean, that's a theme we've talked about a lot before mm-hmm. when we've talked about women, because obviously that's a thing. And I think that's where this movie gets complicated, because, you know, she goes to this retreat center where they basically tell her that this is her own fault for, okay, what?
No, I was nodding along with you.
Oh, okay.
That, yes, that's exactly what happens there.
So they're basically telling everybody there that, like, if you're sick, it's your own fault. Something you've done in your life
because you're not positive enough and you don't love yourself, which, the reason that I made you watch this was because the other day we were talking about Marianne Williamson.
Oh, yeah. That former, is why we were talking about this.
Former candidate for president. Oh, God, I can't. She really freaks me out. And she makes me very nervous because she's made a career in telling people that the reason that they're sick is because they don't love themselves enough. She got her start during the AIDS crisis. So the character, Peter, the guy who runs the retreat center slash cult leader guy, is actually based specifically on Marianne Williamson and this other woman named Louise Hay, who, you know, wrote all these books basically saying, like, if you just tried harder and loved yourself more, you'd be fine, which is the most fucked up thing you can say to someone who's sick. There's a lot of fucked up things
and
you can say.
I agree. And I think where this becomes, like, complicated is that, like, you know, it's not like Julianne Moore is such a mentally healthy person.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, obviously I disagree with the cult. And obviously I don't think anything that's happening to her is her fault. But, like, I don't think it can be denied that a brain-body connection is also mm-hmm. a real thing.
For sure.
And so I think that's where this, like, watching this becomes incredibly complex.
Mm-hmm.
Because they, like, a thing that I noticed is that they also go, like, so in her, there's a point near the end of the movie where her husband and stepson come to visit her at the center. And she develops a lesion on her head while he's there. And so it's like you can see her getting
worse. She's getting worse.
When this man who has like obviously traumatized her in some ways, or at least like, you know, been a part of her not knowing herself. Mm-hmm. So it's like she gets worse when he's there.
I don't know. I think the lesion is already starting before he gets there.
I didn't notice it before, and then I was mad that I was like, oh, did I miss it? Like, when did this start? I couldn't tell.
Yeah. I mean, it's not necessarily him. It actually starts after she goes for that walk, and a truck drives by, and she is there. Is exposed to the fumes from that. And which like goes to show you how like unsafe she is there, that like
they're so close. That's such a lie. The safety bubble that they say that they're in. Yeah.
Right. And so she goes there expecting to get better. And instead she continues to get worse. And then in their group sessions is encouraged to believe that the reason that she's getting worse isn't because she's in an unsafe environment, but is because she's just not trying hard enough. And oh boy, what a fucked up thing. And I have felt that way and been told that so many times that it like really grinds my gears.
Yeah.
But even still, like there's, you know, this movie does not have the narrative arc that we're used to seeing in a movie where, you know, act one, things start to get worse, something changes, act two, act three, there's a climax, and then, you know, things resolve themselves. At the end of this movie, she's moving into a igloo for like total self-isolation. And it's like, that's not what you expect from an illness movie. You know, like usually it's like, you know, they start getting sick, they're trying to get diagnosed, they get diagnosed, they get treated, and either they die or they get better. But instead, in the situation, she's actually getting worse, and the movie leaves off with such an unsettled conclusion that there is no conclusion. I like to think, though, that like, because I think a lot about like, who's Carol now? Like, what would she be up to now if she were a real person, let's say? And I like to think that the sequel to Safe is a Terminator 2 style movie where she's been like, she's seen some shit and she's ready to fight back. So that's my headcanon about this movie.
I could see. I mean, I think Carol. So the movie ends not just with her isolated in her igloo, but like she's looking at herself in the mirror and she's telling herself that she loves herself for what we can only assume is the first time ever. Like, we can assume that this is an extremely difficult thing for her to do and she's doing it for the first time.
Right.
And so, like, it's so confusing because that's both seems very negative and scary, and then also this positive thing at the same time.
Right.
So I think but I think because we see both sides of her in that way, like, I agree with you that, like, she's a fighter. I think she's about to go into some very dark times where she gets stuck in this cult for way too long.
Right.
But I think that she does break out and do good things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because this is something that I see a lot of people with chronic illness go through, and that I went through myself, which is just like, okay, so I'm sick because I'm doing everything wrong. So if I just do everything right, I'll be fine. And I went through this where I was like eating this extremely restrictive diet and exercising constantly and still being like, why do I feel like I'm dying? Everyone said I would be fine if I just did these things and I feel worse. And I see a lot of people go through that, and a lot of people like really, really fully commit to a specific lifestyle that they're told is going to help, and like really wind up in a bad place psychologically because they're doing all of the things and they're doing these things right, and it's still not helping. And what's wrong with me? Why can't I do this right? Why is it working for other people and not me? And the answer is usually because like the other people have something else going on, you know?
Right. Like, and every like, person is not the same. Like,
exactly. And there's not going to be any one size fits all approach to treating and managing a chronic condition that you're probably going to have to deal with for the rest of your life.
Well, and it's like, we've talked about this before, probably while we were recording, where it's like, it also isn't a narrative, a straight line either.
Right.
Like,
oh,
as we expect that it will be. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, okay, this is wrong, and if I do this, I'll get better. And like, right. That's just not how it works for most things, really.
Right. Yeah. Healing is not linear. Sometimes there's no, usually, like, I think that we are under this impression that there is going to be, like, for a long time I was, that there was going to be some end point to the suffering that I was
yeah.
experiencing. And that, like, you know, because I had symptoms for 2 decades before I got, like, a real accurate diagnosis of what was going on. And I, for a long time, was under the impression that, like, if we could just figure out what this is, there will be something to do about it. And then I'll be fine. And that's not the case, it turns out. There's nothing I can really do about it except, you know, supportive care and managing symptoms and whatever. But there's no, you know, like, we in the chronic illness community have a lot of discussions about the concept of a cure, you know, and how, you know, talking about that gives some people hope. But for those of us living with a lifelong condition that comes from, like, our genes are, like, the very basic building blocks of what we're made out of, like, that's not, there is no cure, there's never going to be a cure. So it's really, it can be actually very alienating and upsetting to take a like cure only approach to managing a chronic condition.
Well I think I've always thought the same way about, like, my own mental illness is, like, mm-hmm. when I was, like, younger, I thought that, like, one day I would just wake up and it would be different. Like,
right.
I would be a different person and it would be gone. And, like, if I do X, X, and X and take, like, these medications and whatever, like, you know, then it'll just be gone. And that's, like, mm-hmm. so far from the truth.
Yeah.
And it just has to be managed. And, like, it gets managed in different ways at different times.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. You just keep going and that's
yeah.
it.
it's just, this is just forever. This is going to be for the rest of your life. Yeah. And our culture has no room for that. You know,
yeah.
even when it comes to, like, taking antidepressants, a lot of people think, like, oh, I just have to take this for a certain period of time and then it's going to fix my brain.
Well,
and
so
I'll be able to stop taking
so
them.
So
I
sent you the book that I am, like, mm-hmm. at the very beginning of reading. And, like, that's basically the premise of that book. Like, that guy, the author of that book, like, he, hold on, I'll say the name of it because then I don't have to call it that book, but I don't remember what it is. So it's a book called Lost Connections.
Mm-hmm.
And so he
subtitled, Why You're Depressed and How to Find Hope.
Which is, like, a really shitty subtitle.
I know.
I don't like that. But
well, so, no, is that the subtitle? That's part of the main title. Lost Connections, : Why You're Depressed and How to Find Hope. Subtitle, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions.
Which I also hate. Like,
yeah,
that is not
red
what
flags
reading the book,
all over
I know,
the place.
I know.
For me.
That's not so far. That is not what reading the book feels like at all. Although
yeah.
I could be wrong. I'm still, like, very at the beginning. But, like, basically, this dude was, like, depressed his whole life. Didn't really recognize it as depression. Like, he was just like, I'm sad. Why am I sad all the time? And then eventually one day someone was like, I think you're depressed. And he was like, holy shit, it has a name. And, like, that, he found that really empowering. And this mm-hmm. was also, like, in the mid-90s when, like, you know, SSRIs were, like, a big thing. And so for him, he was like, oh my gosh, it has a name. That means it has a cure.
Mm-hmm.
And basically doctors at the time, like, were acting similarly. They were just like, yeah, you just take this drug. And he was like, yeah, I just take this drug. And so, like, he did, and, like, you know, it would, like, stop working, and then he would take a higher dose and then be like, I'm fine again. And then he had this therapist that was like, hey, I feel like you're still depressed and you're, like, not wanting to, like, see that. And it took him, like, many more years to be like, oh no, that therapist was right. Like, because he was telling himself this story of, like, mm. being cured because of the medication or whatever. And then he was like, oh, that's not real. And then I think really what the book is about, which is I think why I wanted to read it. I don't remember. I do this thing where, like, I belong to a library that has, like, zero books. So, like, every, like, I just end up on wait lists for books for, like, months. And then I'll get the book and be like, why did I want to read this? But what I think this book is actually about is, like, that the circumstances of, like, our world and, like, our capitalist system basically make it impossible for us to be happy, like, legitimately. Like, there's a reason why anxiety and depression are, like, so, so, so prevalent. And, like, it's not really, like, an individual's fault. Like, it's just, like, the world that we've created really
makes us happen
in some ways. Yeah.
It's never anyone's fault.
No.
But yeah. Like, but we in our culture assign, you know, value and whatever the opposite of value is to people's health issues. And it's like, and especially like we literally tie health insurance to employment, you know, like that, like you're not like if you're sick, it's because like there's something wrong with you morally or that you're not working hard enough or whatever, and it's really fucked up. It's
yeah, like there's really just something that I'm supposed to do, like
right. Well, because then that way we can continue to pretend that we don't all live in a society, that we're not all connected and responsible for each other, and that, like, you know, maybe people have to kind of pick up the slack sometimes for
can
when
we maybe
people are having a hard time.
Maybe at this point during the pandemic, we can all just agree that that's not true. Can we just, like, all meet there?
Right. And that illness is not some indicator that you're morally unfit to be part of society. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't pick and choose. I mean, sure, rich people will generally be less sick than people who are not rich, but that's only because they have access and can afford to pay for anything that they want, you know, or need.
Yeah.
But even still, like, she's, like, in the movie, Carol is obviously a very wealthy woman, and even she can't seem to find, you know, the answer, because there isn't one.
Oh, yeah, okay, but so I want to talk about Carol.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, like, I feel like the other... I don't know, wait, I guess I have a question for you. Like, because I know you see this movie through the lens of chronic illness, which mm-hmm. makes sense. And, like, what do you see when you put on the other lens of, like, this woman's life? This woman has not been allowed to know herself, be herself. Like, why put those two things, like, so close together? Like, why? What do you see?
When you say those two things, you mean, like, her illness and her lack of personhood?
Yeah.
I don't know. And I think the first time that I saw this movie, I was annoyed by that. And I was like, why did you have to make it be this, like, pathetic character that's so hard to sympathize with? But I think that is maybe kind of on purpose. She's kind of a vessel, you know, and like an empty one at that. But I think...
No, I don't think she's empty at all.
Why? Tell me more
well,
about that. Well,
I think it's easy to believe that she doesn't know herself and that she's mm-hmm. never made like a single decision in her life that probably mm-hmm. was like on purpose and for her and like... But I don't think that empty is the right word for that. I think
okay.
there's probably a lot, because if she was truly an empty character, this would be so boring, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, obviously Julianne Moore is like an incredible actress, and like I believe, like it's like you can just look at her and know that like there's probably something there. It's just that we don't know what it is because she doesn't know what it is,
mm-hmm.
and. Like, we both just made up this story for after the movie for how we know she's gonna fight, right? So, like, to me, that says that, like, this is just a person who's not been awakened yet.
Yeah.
It's not a person who's gonna be empty
right.
and then die, you know?
Yeah, and I think that so many people are, like, Carol, kind of just going through the motions and floating through their life and not really fully connecting with who they are inside and fully inhabiting their body. So I think that this is actually a very common experience that, it's not until something really fucked up happens to you that you find out who you are. Like we talked about
Oh,
last time about like finding out who you are in times of crisis.
this is, yeah, I do think that, yes, if this movie were to continue, we would watch her kind of do that. But here's why I think it's maybe important in some ways that it's this woman that we're following, because she's a woman with money but without choices, because like we have to assume that she like grew up in a time, came from a family where it was like, you're gonna get married, you're gonna marry a dude that has money, you're gonna be a homemaker, as she calls it. She almost says housewife, and then she's like, I'm a homemaker. And that is what her life is predetermined to be. So that means she doesn't have choices, because she's not and never has been independent in any way. And so I think the interesting thing about watching her is that remains true whether she's with her husband or whether she's with the people at the retreat. Is like she does not have the resources, like physically, mentally, whatever, to be independent in any way. And so she gets put in, yeah, like to put her in those positions looks different on her than it would look on a different character. I think
Interesting.
about that a lot because I listen to You Must Remember This a lot. And like every story about every woman on You Must Remember This is basically just like about a woman with no choices, and who succumbs to, in that case, like the Hollywood system, like in every way, shape, and form, and is like completely destroyed by it. And like it's just like there's a whole lost, like so many lost generations of women because of the circumstances they get put in. Not that men don't necessarily also suffer from other things that trap them, but it's just so specific when, because women, I mean, even still struggle to like obtain the same amount of power in the world and in their
An
lives.
agency, yeah.
Yeah.
I think one of the scariest things in this movie is I find it so disturbing every time I watch it, how much cow's milk she drinks in the first act.
I didn't notice that, although I
Oh
do
my God,
remember her saying it out loud.
she drinks like at least 6 full glasses of milk in this movie.
Ew.
I know. I'm like, oh God, girl, that's why you're sick, which is not true, but it's definitely not helping things.
Well, even her doctor tells her that.
And because he asks if she's like drinking or doing drugs, and she's like, oh no, I'm just a total milkaholic.
Which is gross. And like very like very feels like almost like it's like almost like she's in the wrong decade. It's like she's kind of belongs in like the wholesome, like the fake wholesome, like 1950s or something.
Yeah, but also, I don't remember what attitudes were about milk at the time, but the like late 80s, early 90s diet culture that we see in this, where her friend like goes on a fruit diet and convinces her to do it with her, and it's like the fruit that they order is a fruit salad, which I find hilarious because it's like mostly canned fruit, I think, fruit salad.
I think it depends where you're ordering your fruit salad, but
True. Yeah, that's fair. Fun fact, the waitress in that scene, Todd Haynes' sister.
okay. I do like the speech that Claire gives. Like, I think, like,
She the redheaded
remember?
lady?
She's the redheaded lady with the perm, which I'm like, excuse me, like you're not supposed to be near chemicals. How is your hair permed? But
So when Carol gets her hair permed in that scene, it took them all day to be ready to shoot that because they kept trying to curl her hair and it would just come out like immediately.
Oh,
Because
because she
Julianne
has
Moore
like
just has
beautiful thick straight hair.
straight hair. Yeah, it was just like wouldn't hold the curl. And so by the time they like finally were ready to shoot, it was like 4:30 in the afternoon. And so in the director's commentary, Todd Haynes was like, and it was after that that I figured out that wigs are a good idea.
That's what
And
I was
that's what
going to
we
say.
did
Why
on
didn't they
Velvet
just get
Goldmine.
a wig?
Yeah.
Oh, right. But Claire, like out, like in a different context, like, but and also she's kind of gaslighting, or not gaslighting her. She's
Yeah,
like,
that's not the
she's
right
just
word for it, but
they're
it's
never letting her speak.
manipulative.
They're never letting her speak for herself still, which is something that we've seen is obviously quite challenging for her. And they never leave her the space to do it. They tell her how she feels, and then they tell her that it's normal. But she never says, "This is how I feel." But
She only asserts herself once in the entire movie, and it's after she had that seizure and she's in the hospital bed, and the doctor and her husband are there. And someone comes in and starts
oh,
spraying
yeah.
something, and she's like, "Can you not do that?" And it's like the only time in the movie that she raises her voice or like tries to assert herself, and the doctor is like hammering her, like, "What would make this happen?" And she just whispers, "The chemicals," which kind of makes me laugh, but at the same time, I'm like, "Yes, girl, state your truth." The chemicals. Sorry,
Yeah.
you were saying
I don't know. I just
something.
like what so like the like there are some things that Claire says in her speech that are nice things.
Yeah, well, that's what's so fucked up about that place and that group is like, and what's so manipulative and scary about it and the real life people and groups like this that exist, which is that it's a lot of it is accurate, but they twist it and manipulate it in this way that then kind of turns it into, instead of being something helpful, something really destructive, I think.
Yeah, and something that, yeah, it just becomes super duper negative and scary instead of like instead of love being like the positive force that it
Well,
can be and
positivity,
should be.
yeah, forced positivity can be really toxic and really oppressive.
It's
And
extremely annoying, and it's why I hate Instagram.
and it's something that I talk about all the time in my chronic illness work and when talking to other chronically ill people. And it's one of the reasons why I love Suffering the Silence so much as an entity, and the stuff that we do with them is like, we need to make space for how much this sucks. Like, this fucking blows. It's a really
Well,
fucked up situation. And if we just say, like, we just got to stay positive and just focus on the positives, you don't allow people the room to grieve, which is
right, it doesn't
incredibly
allow for a full
necessary.
range of emotions that are
Exactly.
actually happening, whether you acknowledge them or not.
Right, they're still
And
there.
yeah, and so then not acknowledging them is like, is bad. And I think that, like, I struggle with that sometimes. Not with most people that I hang out with anymore, but like you know, people want to help, and when they want to help you, they say things that do end up sounding like little microaggressions. And it can be really frustrating to try to explain that to somebody, you know.
Well, because people will always try and put a positive spin on something because they think that that's somehow helpful.
Right.
And whenever you're trying to be helpful, just don't, because it's usually not.
Or, you
The
know,
thing
say
that's
what
helpful
can I
is,
do to help you? How, like, what can help you right now? Like, what kind of language helps you? Like,
or just listen.
yeah.
I mean, that's an option. Just let them talk. Don't try and fix it, you know? Acknowledge how hard it must be.
I've tried to make a habit out of with a lot of my friends, I try to be like, "Do you want me to help you fix this right now, or you want to talk about it? You just need to keep talking about it. Like, what do you want right now?"
So my friend Kate is this amazing sex educator, but she also does a lot of work around empathy. And she has this phrase that she tries to teach people, which is when somebody is like venting or they're talking about a difficult situation, something that can be really helpful to ask is, do you want empathy right now or do you want strategy? Because strategy is like, okay, what can we do to change the situation? Empathy is just like listening and acknowledging the hurt and that it sucks and that, like, but like also assuring them that they're not necessarily alone in the situation, which can also be alienating. You gotta read the room, you know? But like, yeah. People are very bad at empathy in general because so often we're so we're all the main characters of our own stories. And so, like, a lot of times when somebody is telling you something difficult, the impulse is to kind of talk about something difficult that you think is somehow somehow relevant to the situation. And very often that turns into a kind of like one-upmanship or like a completely like bypassing what the person is trying to tell you. Simply by like trying to mirror what they're talking about, you're actually building a wall between you. So just
Well, and I
shut up
think
and
too
listen, basically.
that just goes back to being like, what do you want right now? Because like
Right.
there are some instances where people do that for me, and I'm like, actually like hearing about other people's experience.
Yeah,
It's just,
sometimes it can be helpful. Yeah, for sure.
the right thing in the right moment.
Right. And you and I are both people who whine to self-soothe,
We
so
sure do. You should see our Facebook
yeah,
messages.
just complaining constantly. Yeah, it's hard, and navigating this stuff is difficult, and we don't have many good models for, how to have those conversations. But like.
I've tried to just like in my life be like, because for example, I know that I am a person who whines to self-soothe. Like that shit shows up pretty much constantly. And so if I'm in a situation that I know is about to be challenging, like it happens when I train sometimes. And like if I'm with people who don't know me, it's like I'm like, okay, here's what I'm gonna do. It's fine. You don't have to acknowledge it. I'm just gonna do it, and then we're gonna move on.
Just gotta get it out of your system.
So I try to also be like aware, and because all you can do is like teach people how to react to you too, right? Like especially
Yeah.
people who you are dealing with for the first time. I don't know.
Yeah. Give other people the tools to help you. Or
Which is
not.
extremely challenging.
Absolutely.
And I don't even know if I'm good at it. I just know that I
Yeah,
try to
and
do
so many
it.
of us don't know what those tools even are.
Well, no,
You
yeah.
know, like Carol in this movie certainly doesn't know how to help other people help her,
No.
or how to help
No.
herself, or what she needs, or what is even going on with her.
No, it's a thing that takes a lot of practice and like requires like outside help to learn a lot of
And
times.
asking for help too.
Oh,
Learning to ask for help is one of
it's
the
the
hardest things.
worst. The worst.
One of the scenes that, I find the most distressing in this movie that like always makes me cry is the baby shower scene where she's at this party with this group of women and she goes to the bathroom and they're kind of like talking about her while she's not there, like how she like doesn't look okay and somebody heard that she's seeing a therapist and blah 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 blah. And then she eats some ice cream cake and within a few minutes starts having an asthma attack and a few women rush over to help her.
Wait,
But
before that, the kid is sitting on her lap. There's a
yeah,
child on her lap, and
she has a child
like
sitting on her lap.
even before, you can tell that like you can tell something is gonna happen because that's one of the parts that's shot like a horror movie where it's like a slow pan in. But the kid starts crying before you can even really tell what's happening to Carol, and so you just see this child getting upset first, which is I was very stressed out by.
Yeah. But like when the other women see that something's happening, the two women that were talking about her behind her back are like paralyzed with fear. They can't move. They're just like standing there staring at her, and the other women are like rushing her. Somebody's going to call an ambulance. Like, but the thing and I'm, oh God, I'm getting chills just talking about this. The thing that's like so stressful for me about that scene is that like when you're having a medical emergency or like a crisis or whatever, or you don't even know what's happening, it's super unhelpful for a bunch of people to gather around you and look at you and tell you to calm down.
I knew that's what you were gonna say because we have talked about this before.
Yeah. It's
Like at
really
length.
so stressful. And so this is something that I have to navigate on a fairly regular basis. Like I am familiar with enough with my symptoms now that like I can manage them. And sometimes I know like I just have to sit down and like drink a bunch of water and like chill for a moment. And that's not always compatible with whatever it is that I'm trying to do in life at any given time. This actually happened to me a few weeks ago at work, where we were supposed to like go and stand up in front of a bunch of people, and I was really dizzy that morning. And like I knew I was fine, but I also knew that if I stood up for more than 30 seconds, I would probably pass out, and that doing that would be a bad idea. So I had to like wave one of my coworkers into my office and be like, "Please don't freak out. I'm not okay right now, but I'm fine. I can't go and stand up, and I also can't be in a group of people who are all gonna ask me if I'm okay right now, because I'm not, but I'm fine. I have this under control. I just need to not do that, you know?" And it's always like, because a lot of times when you communicate that you're not okay, you then wind up having to comfort the other people
Right,
around
because
you.
everyone else freaks out.
Everyone else freaks out. Yeah. I mean, I've had this happen in doctor's offices where like I'm the one assuring them that like, "Yes, I know my heart is beating at a dangerous rate right now, but I'm fine. Are you okay? 'Cause you seem not okay." You know? And it's so fucked up and it's so stressful. And so like every time I watch that with the women like rushing over, and they're like barely even laying hands on her. They're like afraid to touch her, but they're like crowding her. It just like really stresses me out and makes me so upset.
Yeah.
There was another thing when I watched it this time that I got really upset by, and now I don't remember what it was. But it's so interesting to be able to watch this movie over and over again and like every time find something different that is like, that really hits home or is like super unsettling for me. Oh, it's when she is sitting in bed writing a letter and her husband comes in the room and she says like, "Oh God, what is this?" You know, that like, 'cause I've been there like before I was able to find the accurate diagnoses, like, am I dying? Like, 'cause it really feels like I'm dying, and I don't know what this is, and no one can tell me what this is, and it's so scary. And I just, that's the reason that I love this movie so much, is that like it captures like that, it's like it makes that fear so palpable. This fear that like I lived with for so long, that like, and it's such an isolating experience. And I love forcing other people to watch it. So I can be like,
Well,
this is
wait.
what it's like.
In wistful thinking spirit, when did you first see this?
So I first saw a clip of this back in art school, like 15 years ago, and like thought about it for years and years and years. And it was always really hard to find this movie because it hadn't been reprinted. And, it was just like this little independent movie, even when it came out. So, I finally saw it for the first time like a couple of years ago when the Criterion Blu-ray came out, like the whole thing, and I am just obsessed with it.
So in my art school, we watched a different Todd Haynes Julianne Moore movie.
Wait, we oh yeah, but we also in that American Independent Cinema class that we took together, we saw Poison. They screened
We
Poison in that
did?
class. Yeah.
I've seen that.
I think so.
What happens in it?
It's actually so that's Todd Haynes' first feature, and it's like a what's the word that I'm looking for? Hang on. Brain not working.
Is that the, no. Is that the stop motion Barbie doll one?
No, that is Superstar, the Karen Carpenter story, which is a biopic about Karen Carpenter starring Barbies. It's amazing.
I know, I
It's
really
so
want to
good.
see it. I was reading about it today. But okay, wait, then what's Poison? I don't think I've seen
Poison.
that.
No, I'm pretty sure we watched it in that class. It's like a series of vignettes. So it's not like a full narrative feature. It's like about a few different situations that are, and it was like technically about the AIDS crisis, but also not explicitly. And yeah. But it's also good and very interesting. But yeah, no, Superstar, the Karen Carpenter story is like truly amazing. I love his movies so much. Sorry, I interrupted you. What were you saying?
I don't know. I was just saying in art school, I watched a different Todd Haynes movie. I feel like it was at NYU. We watched Far From Heaven, which is also an incredible movie, and
I've actually not seen that
it's
one.
very good, and it's
I'm sure
based
it
on a
is.
movie called All That Heaven Allows, which is also very good, and watch them together if you're going to watch them. I won't even talk about them very much more, because they're not so related to this, besides the director. And I mean, like, obviously the style is really similar, and there are a lot of similar tools used, because the main woman in that movie is also a woman who's like very trapped in her life.
Todd Haynes has, I don't know if he describes his work this way or if it's something that he's heard other people ascribe to his work, but he said that he makes movies about women in houses.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that. Even just,
Yeah.
I mean, based on those two movies, that's exactly right.
Yeah, and Carol, like his movie Carol is also that as well.
I am just
So.
reading about Poison. Yeah, I don't remember watching this, but I believe you. There's a lot of college that I have blocked out. Was it the same class where we watched Gummo?
Yes.
Because I'm still traumatized from that. That's the old, that's, nope, I can remember watching two movies in that class. One was Gummo, and one was the one about the woman who goes crazy and leaves her family.
Oh, A Woman Under the
Yeah,
Influence.
that one.
Yeah, that was also kind of traumatizing. I have to rewatch that, I think.
Agree.
Yeah. I think that was like one of my parent like one of my parents' like first dates. They went and saw that movie, which honestly explains a lot.
Not a great date movie.
Nope. But tells you everything you need to know about my parents.
Whoa. I wonder why his most recent movie is a, it's described in this Wikipedia as a legal thriller.
Oh, so last year he came out with Dark Waters, which I have
Yeah.
not yet seen, but it is actually also about environmental illness because it's about, I think, the DuPont chemical
Yeah.
company. Yeah, it's like an Erin Brockovich situation.
It just seems like, I mean, environmental themes aside, it seems like a far cry from his
Women in
some of his
houses.
other work. Yeah, from Women in Houses.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah,
I am
maybe.
looking
I don't
forward
know.
to it, though. He also made this wonderful little movie called Wonderstruck that is, God, I don't even know how to describe it. It's two movies, really. One is about this. Okay, so on IMDb, it's described as tells the tale of two children separated by 50 years. In 1927, Rose searches for the actress whose life she chronicles in her scrapbook, and in 1977, Ben runs away from home to find his father. And both of the children are deaf. The girl is played by the little girl that was in A Quiet Place. And it's just, oh my God, it's so good. It's just like not like any other movie you've seen, so I highly recommend it. All of his movies are so good. He's one of my favorite filmmakers. And looking at his IMDb, I see that he's working on a documentary about the Velvet Underground, which I am very excited about and didn't know about until right now.
I think he's a fun director. Like, it would be fun to watch all of his movies because it's not like he has such a large body of work that it's like would be overwhelming to do that.
Yeah.
But he does have such a clear point of view.
Yeah, and it's so interesting to watch a movie like Carol and then go back and watch something like Safe, because Safe is so early in his career, and yet his that point of view and that voice is like so clear already, which I think is really cool. Ooh, he also made an HBO miniseries of Mildred Pierce, which I think was a
I watched that.
Joan Crawford movie, but like back in the day. Yeah, I liked it a lot. It was good,
I did
starring
too.
Kate Winslet. Yeah. Also a woman in a house.
Do you have more things to say about Carol?
You mean about
I'm
Safe?
sorry. I start. Yep. Yep.
It's very
I
confusing that he's
found
made
it.
two movies about women named Carol.
I've not even seen Carol, and I
Oh,
was
it's
getting
so good.
confused while Safe was on because I knew
Yeah.
that he had a movie named Carol. I have the screener. I don't know why I didn't watch it.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's maybe my favorite Christmas movie. Which says everything that you need to know about me personally. But it's beautiful and so sad and truly heartbreaking. And Cate Blanchett. I mean, Cate Blanchett in like gorgeous 50s period garb.
Yeah.
I'll never be done talking about Safe, but I think that's all the things I have to say for now.
Okay, that's all the things I have to say until I watch it again one day.
Thus far this year, I've watched it once a month for various reasons, but maybe I'll just watch it once a month every month throughout 2020. It seems appropriate, doesn't it?
Sure, why not? There are no rules at
Just
this
get re
point.
really upset. Watch a movie and get really upset once a month.
Does your bus to finish?
Oh yeah, I forgot I was driving the bus. How do I land?
You want me to do it?
Yes, please.
Well, Kara, do you want anyone to find you anywhere?
Not really.
Cool. I'm on Instagram at JordoPC. We're doing a weekly schedule now because what else are we even doing with our lives?
I don't know about you, but I have been very busy.
I haven't been. I am so bored. Like I said at the beginning, I'm reaching new levels of boredom. I'm not doing nothing, but it's bad. But it could be worse. Not complaining, just whining to self-soothe. So we'll be back in a week. Who knows what the world will be then? Who knows what we're gonna watch? We'll find out. Bye.
Bye.